Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some announcements today. Bart Stupak, nine-term Democrat from Michigan, will not run for re-election. Ironically, Stupak protested health care reform because he claimed it allowed for federal funding of abortions, even though others said it didn't. He ultimately voted for the bill, saying he was assured there was no federal funding, but his backers still called him a baby killer, and now the Tea Party is claiming victory in his retirement. Also today, the Supreme Court's longest-serving member announced his retirement. Justice John Paul Stevens says he will step down in the summer. He turns 90 in a little over a week. Let's stay there. Jonathan Turley teaches law at George Washington University. Jonathan, it's not really a surprise that he's retiring, and it's assumed that President Obama will appoint a like-minded justice. But what is the impact of this imminent retirement?
Well, first of all, I think there's a cultural impact on the court. I mean, anyone who's ever spoken with John Paul Stevens has liked him. He's one of the most decent human beings you could ever meet. And he brought a certain moderating quality to the court. He's an old model of a justice, a model that I liked. He never really wanted celebrity status. He let his opinions speak for themselves. Unlike some of his colleagues, he didn't speak at political conventions. But he also has a very deep legacy and a fascinating one, where he joined the court as a conservative, replacing William Douglas, and then from 1975 gradually moved over to the left, where he became a rather liberal icon.
Well, and others say that the other thing he brings to the court is sort of a collegial sense of persuasiveness.
He does. And, you know, some of his recent opinions are some of his strongest. I particularly liked his dissent in the enemy combatant case, where he was joined by Scalia, of all people, and they both stood against the idea that George Bush could simply declare citizens to be enemy combatants. It was a particularly elegant moment for the court, I thought, to have those two together. But he is a very mature influence on the court, and he's going to be dearly missed for that. And for many liberals, he also is going to see sort of the passing of an era. Even though he began as a conservative, he served at the high point of the liberal court, replacing William Douglas, serving with William Brennan, Thurgood Marshall. Those times are largely gone for liberals, of these sweeping civil liberties rulings. And I think that there's a sense of loss to see the last of these great names move from the court.
Well, two of his other decisions that come to mind, the Citizens United decision, the recent one that allowed corporations to spend freely on political campaigns, he disagreed with that decision. That might have been predictable, but then there was the ruling allowing flag burning, and Justice Stevens disagreed with that and sided with, I think, Rehnquist and other conservatives.
Was a bit quirky on that. He was a big supporter of the First Amendment, but he has a real deep patriotism that often seems to influence his decisions. I disagreed with him in that dissent. I thought that he was on the wrong side. But he has other rulings, particularly in terms of student speech, where he has been a real lion fighting for the right of free speech and free press.
Well, of course, Jonathan Turley, wanted to have you back to talk extensively about who some of the candidates might be to replace Justice Stevens. It's assumed it might be someone with his same thinking. But what other statements might President Obama want to make with an appointment?
Well, liberals are going to be looking very closely at what he says, because some of the people that have been mentioned on the short list are more moderate to conservative, much like Sonia Sotomayor, his last appointment. And I think liberals are going to look for reassurance that they're going to put a true liberal there. But, I mean, these types of statements have one purpose only, and that is to honor someone who deserves to be honored. You know, Stevens has served this country in a unique way, not just on the court, but in the military. He's a quintessentially American figure. He's a decent and honorable person.
Looking forward, here's the announcement that he will retire in summer. Do you think there will be a replacement by the summer?
I think so. You know, he's timed this perfectly for Obama, because if he waited till after midterm elections, it could run into serious, serious trouble. Obama has more ability now to appoint someone who is liberal. The question is, will he do that? And that's a real concern among civil libertarians, because there's a lot of cases that are resting on a 5-4 split.
Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. Jonathan, weighing in on Justice John Paul Stevens' announcement that he will step down this summer. Thanks so much.
Thanks a bunch.
Okay, switching gears. Malcolm McLaren, manager of the Sex Pistols, died yesterday of cancer at 64. He's being called the original punk rocker, a seminal figure, and we're guessing his death will throw a certain segment of fandom into mourning. We'd plan today to take a look at the hold that rock and roll music has on its fans, fans who attach themselves to bands like the Sex Pistols, or to rock in general. They own more than 3,000 albums. They would break up with someone if that person loved the wrong music, say Air Supply. Or conversely, if a date is going well, they might casually turn on Chuck Prophet's Summertime Thing as if they hadn't planned it days in advance. There's a party next door that sounds like it's cooking. I poked my head over the wall, took a look in. Was a five-piece band, they was really some kind of family reunion. Hey, it's a summertime day. Author Steve Almond knows a thing or two about what he calls drooling fanatics. He's been on our program talking about political literature or Kurt Vonnegut. He's passionate and ridiculously so about music. He writes about his long-running obsession in his newest book, Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. And Steve joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Yes, good to be here.
Tell us more about fanatics. How does one qualify?
Everybody qualifies because everybody has a little inner fanatic, but some of us have an outer fanatic, and we do things like have way too many albums. I think I'm up to about 5,000. We tend to make a lot of mixed CDs. We made mixtapes back in Gramps' day, and we don't just give them to people, but request that those people listen to them so carefully that they can comment in detail on the syncopated hand claps in track 14, please. We would get very evangelical about particular bands, and we start to call the members of the band by their first names as if they are our friends, which
they
are
not.
No, they are not.
You keep gratuitous lists. Of course, there's the Desert Island playlist. What would you take to a desert island? But you also have things that would, well, this isn't the word you use, but that would anger critics.
Yes. Music critics, I don't know, you know this, they're kind of prickly people. I say this as a recovering music critic, but if you say things like, oh, Sonic Youth, are they the ones that do Pass the Duchy, you know, that's going to make a critic mad. Or people who don't like Steve Miller should move to Canada.
Well, and you recently wrote a piece about how critics don't really get what it feels like to be a fan. What does it feel like that no one's getting?
Well, it's impossible to write about music because music is something that people receive as an emotional experience. When you think about listening to your favorite song or a song that means so much or stood for some era of your life, it's kind of a collaboration of your own crazy needs emotionally and whatever the musician triggers. And that's going to be totally different. You might listen to Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor, for instance, and think, oh, what a fun song. I remember feeling empowered as a woman when I was whatever, you know, 18. My wife listens to it and thinks about getting dumped, you know, when she was 15 years old working in a CVS and down in Connecticut, because it's a totally case-by-case personal thing.
And for you, it started in 1978. A lot of people are going to identify with this, with older siblings. Your brother loved Styx, so you loved Styx, and one day you ran in the room to tell him something about Styx, and he said...
He said, dude, Styx sucks. Get out of my room.
Something.
Yes. He could not have found a more devastating thing to say at that moment, and I was like, what do you mean Styx? Styx are geniuses. Styx
are
like
Mozart.
And you told
me they were geniuses, right.
Yeah, and exactly. You were the one who got me into this Styx thing, but by that time he'd moved on to the Police. As a younger sib, you're pretty much sort of the Casey Kasem of your older brother's existence. Once you're into the same music as them, they know that that music is over and they move on to the next thing.
horrible. So you're cut off from siblings, but then you write that that's sort of the point of rock and roll. You have to approach it alone.
Or I should say that the kind of person I'm writing about, the drooling fanatic, spends a lot of time alone. And music, when you're really listening to great music, you're not really alone in a sense. You're sort of feeling certain things that are probably you don't want to feel in front of other people anyway. I mean, I can remember sitting on my rug in the living room, this is in the era of the turntable, and listening to songs from The Key of Life, you know, by Stevie Wonder, and listening to a song like Village Ghetto Land or Sir Duke, and it was like an entire activity. That sense of needing music to reach certain feelings that you can't reach without music is at the heart of this book.
Right, and it also connects to your other recommendation that people have musical guardian angels. It was your uncle who gave you that album.
Yeah.
And you say it's also a part of the other important factor, which is studying. You looked at the album cover for the Rolling Stones' Goat's Head Soup for an entire year.
Oh, my God. I spent 1975 just studying it. There's the goat's head. It's in soup. Now, what happens to the fur? What happens to the horn? Does one eat the horn? How about the eyes? Are those sort of there just for flavor, or does one actually eat the eyes? But that sounds sort of ridiculous to the iPod generations. It's like, well, I'd be texting and emailing and so forth. But, you know, back then, that was what you did. You listened to a record, you learned those songs, your body in a certain way learned those songs, and you just studied the album, and that was the whole activity.
In fact, you do an entire exegesis on Toto's Africa. Some people who think that it's the cheesiest thing ever.
Yes.
There are some of us. Perhaps revealing to my for whom it's.
Are you
my...
blessing the rains right down in Africa right now, Robin?
I sort
Young?
Of am.
I figured.
But isn't that the point?
Yeah, I think everybody has the superego that says those songs are so cheesy you can't like those songs. And then there's the part of you that if you heard that on the radio, you would totally be like, oh yeah, I do bless the rains down in Africa. I forgot how awesome that song is. It's really a song that elicits both love and then hatred for your love of the song. I love that kind of music.
I see problems down the line. I know that I'm mine.
Welcome back.
Oh, my darling, oh, my darling, how can you forget?
We've Never Met by Nico Case, just one of hundreds of songs mentioned in Steve Almond's new book, Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. And Steve, this comes in your chapter about moments when songs do something to the listener. For instance, a moment when you saw Willie Nelson on the David Letterman show.
Dave Letterman says to him at some point, why don't you sing something for us, Willie, in that sort of slightly ironic, taunting Dave Letterman way. And I remember Willie Nelson kind of sitting back, and he just began to sing.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, and just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
And it was the most astonishing moment because the whole veneer of David Letterman, that sort of ironic posture on life, was just obliterated. And it was like the audience was just knocked back on their tush and just going, oh my God, this is art.
Yeah.
We're supposed to feel things, you know.
For me, it was also the David Letterman show, but it was when Cyndi Lauper first performed Time After Time.
Yep.
If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. If you fall, I will catch you, I'll be waiting. Time after time. If you're lost, you can look and you will find me. Time after time. If
Yeah, it does stand still. Yeah. But that's what songs are. They're like time machines. You know, when you hear a particular song, you're just instantly transported to a certain place. And it's not just a physical place either. When I hear Sunday Bloody Sunday by U2, I kind of get psyched to be a member of the Irish Republican Army. Like, I'm like, yeah, let's do this thing, man. I'm Irish. And I'm not Irish. I am Jewish. You know, I'm a suburban Jewish guy. And that's the amazing thing about songs. They sort of make you feel these things that are patently ridiculous but feel totally true when you're listening.
I can't believe the news today. Oh, I can't close my eyes and make it go away.
You get behind singers who maybe don't make it to the upper firmament, but you believe in them more than they do. One is Ike Riley.
Yep.
You traveled outside Chicago to meet him.
Hip hop has blown my mind. John Cash has done it.
There seemed to be sort of, I'm not as big as you think I am, and you're reminding me of that.
Yeah, that's exactly what the dynamic was, because these guys aren't dumb. They know that they're important artists, and I think it's very painful for guys like that, Boris McCutcheon, Dana Kurtz, Nil Lara, all the folks who I really became evangelical about. They all know that they love music and they love what they do, but it's not reaching as many people as it deserves to, and my devotion sort of reminds them of that, so it's kind of bittersweet.
Tell us about Boris McCutcheon. He's from Woods Hole on the Cape here in Massachusetts.
His voice has this quality where you just go, I need to listen to this person. This person has important data for my heart. I saw him at the VFW, and I instantly ran around the party saying, who is he? I must have his music. I got his album, and I listened to that album probably 50 times in the next week. I just was absolutely entranced by it.
I'm setting this on to the rain on the bone. Won't you sell it, mind it? Escape from home. Some was gone, but it did not care. I was on good time with the plowman's daughter, and I can see.
Well, in Boris McCutcheon's case, he seemed to be looking at you with sort of a sadness, like, Steve, you don't understand. I don't know if I can go as high as you want me to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's this thing where to become a rock star, especially in this culture with all the zillion channels that are out there, you have to be super organized and good at marketing yourself and all this stuff that is really flies against the artistic temperament. You know, I went to do this story about Dave Grohl, you know, Foo Fighters, was in Nirvana. And meeting him was like, wow, this guy really has it all under control, way more than I do, way more than Boris does. And this is part of the reason, in addition to insane talent, that he's become so successful. But I like the guys like Boris who, they're a little rougher around the edges. They're in it for the art, and they'd like people to reach the art, but they know that it's not going to be, you know, brought to you by Walmart. They just don't have that in them.
Wow, and at this point in your story, do we smell maturity?
No.
maybe. Or maybe it's that you finally found the woman who can match your passion for music, your wife, Erin, who had her own soundtrack, only it was a little bit different.
She was a metalhead. You know, she was a metal chick, and she was really tuned into, you know, Metallica, Poison. You know, she was somebody who needed to be emotionally liberated, who needed to know that there was a bigger world out there, and that's part of what heavy metal says to kids without a lot of prospects. Hey, it's possible.
Say your prayers, it's a warning. Don't forget my son to include everyone. I tuck you in, all within. Keep you free from sin till the Sandman he comes.
And you communicated music. I'm thinking of Joe Henry's Fuse.
Oh, yeah. On like our first or second date, I played her Joe Henry, and it wasn't like some random thing. I really wanted her to hear this music. I think it's incredibly sexy. And so I'm playing her this song, and we kind of are dancing, you know, sort of slow dancing.
Here comes the night, let go your knees, reaching for the floor. You say I'll stand guard down here, she stands in the door.
She just said, wow, who is this? You know, what is this music? And I thought, this is a keeper, you know, because she got it. And that's pretty much sort of the glue. We had some rough times, and I think music has really been the glue that's kept us together.
Steve Almond's new, wildly entertaining book, Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life. Steve, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Rock on.
And there she goes. She's a hauling cane. Like it was gold.
Let's check in Kyrgyzstan. The remote Central Asian country is suddenly on the front pages and the front burner after political unrest flared into violence this week. Security forces killed dozens of protesters. Then the country's president fled the capital but hasn't conceded defeat. The opposition leader has assumed power and has the support of Russia, which has a military base there, as does the U.S. In fact, it's the only country where both the U.S. and Russia have bases. Kyrgyzstan is also a main portal to neighboring Afghanistan. So let's check in. The BBC's Ryan Dimitri is in the capital city of Bishkek. Ryan, we know today was a day of mourning for people killed in the protests. What's it been like?
Today we saw lots of people, hundreds of people gathering at the scene of mass protests on April the 7th. So people were gathering to lay flowers, to mourn the victims of that day. 75 people died as a result of clashes between the protesters and security forces, and over 1,500 got injured. We've also visited some injured people in the hospital today. And what they were telling us is that they don't have regrets, even though they're lying there in pain, bleeding. They say that it was time for this president to go, because President Kurmanbek Bakiyev, who came to power 5 years ago and promised a lot of things, he came to power off the back of mass protest, and he was an opposition leader, but he didn't fulfill any of those promises. That's what people were saying. And the situation in their country, the economic situation, is dire. There are no jobs.
Well, President Bakiyev came to power in, as you say, the so-called Tulip Revolution. Now we have a new opposition leader, Roza Otunbayeva, who's a former foreign minister and ambassador to the U.S. and Britain, who says she has assumed power. Has she? Because there's been reporting that the president might try to organize a force to retake the capital. So have the security forces acknowledged the new leader?
Yes, they have. There's more sense of order now. Regarding President Bakiyev, he was giving interviews to a number of media organizations in which he said that he is still the president of Kyrgyzstan. But he believes that if he gets back to Bishkek, to capital Bishkek, he will be killed. And most importantly, President Bakiyev said that the opposition government will close the U.S. airbase here in Kyrgyzstan.
What's the importance to the U.S. of a base in Kyrgyzstan?
Manas base is incredibly important for U.S. operations in Afghanistan. The majority of U.S. and NATO troops, they go to Afghanistan via this base. So they stop here for 48 hours and then they're sent off to Afghanistan, which is less than 2 hours flight away. And we've seen in the last year or so, when President Bakiyev said that he wants to close this base, there was a lot of tension, because that announcement came at the same time when Russia promised huge loan, they promised huge credit, up to $2 billion it promised to Kyrgyzstan. The Kyrgyz president never admitted that, you know, he will receive that money in exchange for closing the U.S. base.
So it sounds as if the president in exile is still trying to play the U.S. and the Russians against each other. But can this really be seen as sort of a proxy battle between Russia and the U.S.? We just saw the leaders sign a nuclear treaty this week. Is there a sense that there's still tensions over the bases?
I think you're very right at pointing that President Bakiyev is trying to play two big powers against each other. When the head of this interim government, Roza Otunbayeva, was asked the question about the U.S. military presence in this country, she said they're not against it and they will look at this issue at later stage, but at this stage they are not against U.S. military presence in their country. So we're yet to see how this story will develop. There's definitely more to come on Russia's role, whether Russia did play any role in this protest, and what role is it going to play in the days to come, you know, in helping to restore order in this country.
The BBC's Rayhan Dimitri speaking to us from Bishkek, the capital of Kyrgyzstan. Rayhan, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin. It was a pleasure.
And a quick note, next time on Here and Now, NPR's bureau chief in Afghanistan, Soraya Sahardi Nelson. She'll open her incredible reporter's notebook. Also, we'll ask the question, should a 13-year-old climb Mount Everest? That's next time. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. That 27-year-old Qatari diplomat who set off a terrorism scare this week is being sent back home by his embassy, avoiding the U.S. possibly having to expel him. Mohammed Al-Madadi was on a United Airlines flight from Washington to Denver on Wednesday when he made a joke about setting his shoes on fire after he was asked if he'd been smoking in the bathroom. He was on his way to a routine monthly visit with Ali Al-Mari, a Qatari citizen who's in jail in Colorado after admitting he'd come to the U.S. the day before 9/11 on the orders of alleged 9/11 architect, colleague Sheikh Mohammed. Scott Shane is national security reporter for the New York Times. And Scott, this story unpeels like an onion. It also reveals that there were marshals, federal marshals, on that flight that Al-Madadi was on, and people did smell smoke. So a little about the flight. Did he ever admit to smoking?
Not in the initial encounter. Apparently what happened was he went to the forward lavatory. He was sitting in first class, and the forward lavatory, as people know, is, you know, near the cockpit, and so they get concerned about that. And as he was leaving, apparently a flight attendant thought she smelled smoke and asked him if he'd been smoking. He denied it, but she alerted one of the two air marshals on the flight. These are the guys who dress as passengers, and ordinarily you wouldn't know that they were marshals, and the marshal went and confronted him, and apparently at that time is when he made this unfortunate joke about trying to set his shoes on fire.
Unfortunate. Well, you know, as a lot of people are saying, talk radio is abuzz with this, a lot of people are saying if it were them, they would have been bound right there. But passengers said it was very civil, and the federal marshals activated a national alert system. Just remind us what happened in the air.
You know, the pilot has a way of informing the ground that there's an incident. It sets a lot of different things in motion. Within just a few minutes, there were top Homeland Security officials on a conference call. They sent a message to all 4,900 flights that were in the air at that time, saying that there had been this incident and mentioning the possibility of shoe bombing. They scrambled NORAD, scrambled two fighters to escort this United flight into Denver. In fact, even President Obama was informed.
Well, now you begin your report by asking, was this the security system working, or was this, you know, overkill? And we wondered, wow, a guy is probably smoking and makes a joke about setting his shoes on fire. Is there anyone saying it was overkill?
You know, I kind of hunted around, talked to several people yesterday, including some who have been quite critical of what they consider to be overreactions to the terrorist threat. And in general, I found very few critics of this response. I think part of that's because of what everybody remembers happened on Christmas Day. It was a very serious attempt to bring down a plane.
Well, another reaction that we're hearing is anger, because Mr. Madadi has some diplomatic immunity. As you write, he could be expelled from the U.S., but that's a moot point now because his embassy is bringing him home. What more do we know about him? Was there concern that he might be a terrorist even though he was a diplomat?
Well, when something like this happens, in addition to everything else that I described was going on, they were urgently entering his information into all the intelligence agencies' computers and, in fact, looking at the entire passenger list, because they're always concerned that there might be a team of terrorists on a plane like this. I'm told they came up with basically nothing. This guy just turned 27, his first diplomatic assignment as a very junior diplomat in the embassy of Qatar. He's the son of a diplomat. He's almost as American as he is Qatari. He went to high school and also did a college degree in the U.S. So, you know, I think in retrospect, while, as you say, people are angry and so on, I think it looks like a young guy doing stupid things.
Well, but you write that authorities, officials, weren't going to look the other way because he was a diplomat. The thinking was, why not a diplomat?
Sure, they're always wary of Al-Qaeda picking someone unexpected to carry out an attack. So a former administrator of the Transportation Security Administration yesterday was talking about, you know, they look for pregnant women, they look for couples with babies. They try not to profile in the narrow racial or ethnic sense because they know that Al-Qaeda is actually quite aware of stereotypes and wants to work against them. So a diplomat might, you know, in theory, be a good choice.
And what about the man he was visiting, Ali Al-Mari, who was arrested in December of 2001? It was thought he was potentially part of a second wave of attacks. He admitted to coming to the U.S. at the request of 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, convicted last year. Tell us a little bit about how he went through the court system.
Well, Ali Al-Mari was arrested initially on regular criminal charges related to financial fraud, but very soon he was accused of terrorism and moved into the military system. And he was held for years in the Brig, in the military jail in Charleston, South Carolina, where he alleges he got some pretty rough treatment, and he was kept in solitary confinement for a long time. But his case posed serious legal problems to the system as the Bush administration struggled to figure out how to handle terrorism in the criminal system or in the military system. And ultimately, he was moved back into the criminal system and sentenced last year to 8 years in prison.
The Supreme Court had agreed to hear his case. He was on his way when the Obama administration actually moved his case back to the Justice Department and into the criminal system, and he was convicted. Was that seen as a, you know, trying to head off a potential Supreme Court decision that he couldn't be tried?
Yes, I think in both the case of Jose Padilla and this guy, Ali Al-Mari, there were gyrations back and forth between the military and criminal system, and part of it was based on a desire to avoid what the government considered to be an adverse precedent at the Supreme Court.
So he is now serving time in a super facility in Colorado. Scott Shane, is there a sense, actually in two ways, that the systems worked here? The alleged Al-Qaeda operative is behind bars, and the air system was able to react to this young diplomat in the air?
Yes, well, I mean, I guess I should say that, unlikely as it seems, it is a complete red herring and coincidence that this young diplomat happened to be on his way to see a convicted member of Al-Qaeda at the time authorities briefly suspected him of being a terrorist. In fact, this kind of visit is routine, and the U.S. does it with their diplomats to visit Americans imprisoned abroad. So it's a completely ordinary process, and while it was a bit jarring when the authorities discovered the purpose of the diplomat's trip, they have concluded that this was just a stupid joke and that he has no ties whatsoever to terrorism.
Scott Shane, national security reporter for The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, your thoughts? Just go to hearnow.org. You can click on Contact Us to send an email or leave a comment right there. Before we go, Carol Burnett, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. When my late mom was fading, we brought her as many of her old beloved television shows as we could find. Dean Martin, or The Carol Burnett Show. A 70s Saturday night tradition in millions of homes, it featured songs and skits performed by Carol and company, Harvey Korman, Tim Conway, Vicki Lawrence. It had takeoffs of old movies performed in fabulous Bob Mackie costumes. And to start, Carol Burnett would ask that the lights be turned up so the live studio audience could ask questions.
Pardon me? Where did you inherit your gorgeous legs from?
What a cute thing! Who did I inherit my gorgeous legs from? Why, you... How old are you?
14.
You little devil.
Carol Burnett now occasionally does a roadshow based on audience questions, and she sprinkles some of the best throughout her new book, This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection. And Carol joins us from WNYC in New York. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Hi.
Hi. Remind us of a couple other questions that people asked you. I like the recent one when someone asked, if you could come back as anyone, what would it be?
I think that's the weirdest one. About a year ago, so it was in Texas, and this lady in the balcony raised her hand, and she said, Carol, if you could be a member of the opposite sex for 24 hours and then pop back into being yourself again, who would you be and what would you do? Well, you know, I said, what in the world? And I swear, Robin, I said a little prayer real fast. Okay, God, I don't know what's going to come out, but I'm just going to open my mouth and whatever comes out is your fault. And I said, I'd be Osama bin Laden and I'd kill myself.
You know, a serious topic and, you know, but wow, that was quick. And, you know, and in telling the story, I think I just heard Eunice surface. Did I?
Oh, well, the lady in the balcony, because that was kind of the Texas accent that I always used as Eunice. Loved doing her. And Vicky doing Mama right. was phenomenal.
You are really nuts, you know it? One of these days they're going to come over here and just lock you up. You lay off of me. You aren't playing with full deck, Eunice.
Well, in your autobiography, your previous book, we learned about your alcoholic but beloved parents, the grandma mm-hmm. who raised you, and you know, the one you pull your earlobe for even to this day. But some of us also learned for the first time that a benefactor gave you $1,000 to go to New York to try to make it big way back when.
Right.
And I feel like that, you know, learning more about this, you know, wide-eyed girl who comes to New York, I feel like then we see her in your later characters. I'm thinking of the story you tell where you go into a restaurant. Oh, it's that wonderful Rumpelmeyer's
yes.
in New York. Very fancy dessert restaurant. And you go in with some friends. I mean, this is where, you know, you've got a little spare change yeah. in your pocket. And the woman just starts to turn you away because you have pants on.
Screaming at me. I had on slacks. And she said, what do you kids think you're doing here coming into Rumpelmeyer's wearing slacks? I mean, she was really rude. And I had seen Marlene Dietrich in there at one time at lunch in slacks having a soda. And I thought, well, that's not right. And I said, I'm so sorry, but I have a wooden leg. I can't wear skirts yet. Well, I'm telling you, all of the patrons in the restaurant, they all but went boo to her.
and you dragged your leg.
And she led us across the room to a little table in the back, and I was just kind of limping with my leg and sat straight-legged, and I had a wonderful ice cream sundae.
So a lot of this physical comedy that we saw in your show, you actually were like that in real life.
I guess so, Robin.
I just want to give people a taste of early Carol Burnett. We'll have two things in a row here. The first, your first big Broadway show, Once Upon a Mattress.
Actually, my full name is Winifred the Woebegone, but Winifred's a little too formal. You can call me by my nickname.
Winnie?
Fred.
Also, this is your life, Carol Burnett. At the same time, you were also performing on Gary Moore's show. We have a little sound from that.
Well, Honeykins, don't you remember me? I'm your husband.
Why, it is you, Big Daddy. What brings you out to the bright light?
It's the baby. She's crying for a ma.
And you also were on Password. I want to try.
I don't think I can tell this story.
Well, let's try carefully.
There's no way to say it.
Well, I was going to rhyme things because you had to guess a word. The word in this case was tweet, but the man playing with you thought that there might be a past tense of tweet, and it's a mm-hmm. word that rhymes with what?
Squat.
That's good. And he said this word, which is a very vulgar word, and it was live.
It was live.
What did you do?
I just stared at him. And the audience was laughing. It was mayhem, absolute mayhem. And then finally, you know, the buzz. And blessedly, that was over.
And the show was never live again.
that's true.
The Carol Burnett Show, of course, a huge success. We have to play some of the classic scenes. Here's Went with the Wind, where you spoofed the scene in Gone with the Wind, Scarlett meets Rhett. wearing a dress. She's made from old curtains. In this case, the curtain rod still in your shoulders. Let's listen.
Scarlett, I love you. That gown is gorgeous.
Thank you. I saw it in the window and I just couldn't resist it.
Carol Burnett, how does it feel to be the centerpiece of the funniest moment in television ever?
Robin, that came through Bob Mackie's genius, our costume designer.
Well, the dentist scene with Corman and Conway. And Tim Conway is the young dentist who keeps sticking himself with the Novocaine.
Let's see how this works here. Okay, Novocaine. Here we are, Novocaine. Take a firm hold of the hypodermic needle. Right.
I think that's one of the funniest sketches that was ever, ever done on television, and it should be in a time capsule.
Yeah. What do you think your impact has been on younger women? We were thinking, could anybody as pure and open as Carol Burnett come out of this sort of internet age where we're all sort of more cynical? And then I thought, well, yeah, Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my attitude was nurtured by seeing so many movies in the 1940s, where there was nothing cynical about anything. The bad guys got it. The good guys won. Everything was hopeful. So when I came to New York on my own, not knowing what in the world I was doing, I'd never been any further east in Texas, but I never thought that good things wouldn't happen. Now, maybe today, if that situation were the same, I might not have been that confident because there is a lot of cynicism and edgy humor and all of this. There's a lot of negativity out there that could kind of make you stop and take good stock of yourself. Oh, I don't know if I could do that, But in those days, it was like, yeah, let's go try. Let's do it. And I never took anything personally when I didn't get the job. What I always thought was, well, it's not my turn. That's her turn. My turn will come.
Yeah. Not all laughs. Of course, a full life, and it included two divorces, and then the death of your daughter.
That's right. And I always feel her presence with me. She was quite a force, and she's a little angel on my shoulder all the time.
Yeah. Wow, you're crowded there with your grandma.
Yeah.
And your earlobe.
Yeah.
That's Carol Burnett, one of the good guys. Her new book is This Time Together, Laughter and Reflection. Carol Burnett, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm so glad we had this time together, just to have a laugh